Innovation Conversations from the Southwest Innovation Expo.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Innovation Conversations from the Southwest Innovation Expo, recorded here at Sandy Park in Exeter. This episode focuses on the biodiversity net gain legislation that became mandatory in England on the 12th of February and on the 2nd of April for small developers. This means that new developments must offset the impact they have on biodiversity by paying for the creation of new habitat elsewhere. With us to talk more about biodiversity net gain credits, we have Dr. Ben Bamford, the postdoctoral research fellow in environmental economics from the University of Exeter. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
We also have Amy Coulthard, director of operations for Entrade. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Paul.
And also we have Dan Bloomfield, impact and partnership manager for nature recovery and food systems for Exeter Innovation. Hello, Dan. Right, they're a great panel. I've been told that you know everything about this subject. So my first question is, can you break down this topic of biodiversity net gain? What does it mean? Who wants to go first?
I don't mind taking that one. Essentially, it's a new planning policy that's come into force this year. And all new developments have an impact on the natural environment. So for all developments, housing or schools or care homes, whatever, there will be some degree of impact on local habitats. So there'll be some habitat that is lost through those developments. And previously, developers were required to do some mitigation for that loss through, you know, possibly some small-scale habitat improvements and so on. So this legislation goes one step further and actually requires developers to leave the natural environment hopefully in a better state than prior to development. So it's requiring them to create more habitat than has been lost.
It sounds to me that there's going to be a lot of conversations going on between different entities. Who needs to communicate to who with regards to this?
We all need to communicate with each other. There are some really innovative platforms and ideas around that can bring together major stakeholders, landowners, developers, financial tool developers, and environmental groups. And I'm glad to say that in the Southwest, we are looking at quite strongly reproducing what the North has done with Nature North, who are here today and are going to talk about one potential solution, which is to cross the region, bring together the funding opportunities and the nature gain opportunities, which is important. But there are lots of competing models out there, lots of competing platforms, and it's quite an exciting time because essentially, not only is this an opportunity for nature, this is also clearly an opportunity for income generation and income distribution.
Ben, I'm going to bring you in on this. Now, it sounds like this might maybe prevent future developments from taking place. Is that the case?
I think not really is the kind of short answer. The slightly longer answer is there will be some developments which are going to be happening in places which are really precious in terms of their biodiversity impacts. And those developments are going to be encouraged to move elsewhere because simply getting the credits that they now require, that offset that they will now need, is going to be so expensive for them that actually it's probably not worth going ahead with the developments. So we might see shifts in developments and where they're taking place to areas that perhaps have less impact on biodiversity. But broadly, no, I don't think this is going to reduce the amount of development going ahead, but rather changing where it happens. Of course, that does rely on really well-functioning markets that are going to be able to bring together these developers and landowners who can come forward with habitat creation projects. But so long as those are in place, then I think, no, we're not going to be seeing overall reductions in development, or not large reductions in development anyway.
Amy, how does this all work in terms of rolling out and the limitations that it will bring into place?
For biodiversity net gain to be rolled out and be really successful, what we've needed to have is a pipeline of projects. So on the landholder side, so on the land management side, projects delivering that habitat creation that's needed to generate the biodiversity units that are required by developers to offset. On the one side, you've got to have that project supply. That's really vital. So there's been quite a long time of planning for biodiversity net gain, which is one of the reasons why we don't think it's going to prevent development going ahead, because actually there's a lot of people that have been preparing for this for quite some time. We knew it was coming, and there's been adequate time for that pipeline of projects to develop. So there's already in existence, as Dan said, a variety of different models out there. So people that have developed habitat banks, for example, like Entrade, where we've been developing, we've worked on a project pipeline with private landowners who are then bringing those projects to market through our trading platform. So that's one thing that's needed, is a strong pipeline of projects. The other is for buyers to understand how many units they need. So they need to have already got quite advanced plans for their developments, and to have got a method for quantifying the amount of biodiversity units that they need. So those methodologies exist. So you need a standard for quantifying the number of biodiversity units that are required. And the standard that's being used is the statutory metric, so the biodiversity metric that's been developed by Natural England, so along with DEFRA, and that's been published now as well. So you've got that method for buyers to be able to calculate, developers to be able to calculate what their needs are. Then what you need is the operators in the middle to bring those two different sides of the markets together. And that's absolutely the space that Entrade operates as the market operator working with Exeter University.
And what kind of questions and concerns have you been hearing from the marketplace, I guess?
It is an exciting time, oddly enough, for nature conservation at the moment, because not only is there this sudden possible source of substantial money, which it hasn't been for decades, it's also at the very top of many, many policy agendas, finally. And that is happening at the same time that, as we all know, nature is absolutely under the cosh. It's bad news everywhere you look, it seems. So for those reasons, there's a lot of urgency and innovation happening in this space. And the university has got a huge amount of research expertise and partnerships which it can bring to bear to create the sorts of solutions that are required to make this happen. Because it is novel, and it is there are communities of people and actors and people who actually do nature conservation. It's very new to a lot of them, the idea that they might be benefiting from trading credits or what the platforms are and so on. So it's a lot of learning to be done, as well as innovation. So
innovation and learning.
I think some of the other concerns that have been expressed around this are concerns around greenwashing. There's lessons that we've had to learn from other environmental markets. So biodiversity net gain is driving these new nature markets. It's one element anyway that's driving those, along with the sort of corporate biodiversity markets that we're seeing on the horizon. And so there's a lot of concerns from both project developers, so people that are interested in putting habitat enhancement on their land, and the NGOs and others, about actually, you know, being sure that the habitat enhancement is actually there, the biodiversity uplift that we're expecting for the 10% gain, want to know that it's there, want to know that what has everybody said is being delivered will be delivered, and avoid that greenwashing. And it's the same for businesses. They don't want to risk buying biodiversity units and then finding out later on that actually what they've bought hasn't been delivered properly, it's not to the required standard, and so on. So it's really important that we have frameworks and that marketplaces are properly designed and well organised and have appropriate legal frameworks and the right processes for verification and monitoring and so on. All of that's really important to have in place.
Ben, how does this all filter down to the consumer, the average person? What kind of impact will this have on you and I?
Largely not very much. I guess it's going to, as I said, shift where development happens. And you're going to see when that development does go ahead, habitat being put back that otherwise would not, right? So compared to a world in which this legislation doesn't exist, as kind of was historically the case, we're going to be seeing habitat being restored in places that otherwise it would not be being. So I think that's probably the largest impact that we're going to notice, so long as these markets are functioning really rather well for biodiversity and for that habitat that needs to be put back, then we're probably not going to see large impacts. I think the one real concern that we have seen, so for instance, in nutrient neutrality, which is very similar rules, but only in particular localities within England, also obviously for nutrients rather than for biodiversity, and the impact that development has there on waterways. What we have seen is developments being held up, and indeed lots of areas where development simply hasn't been happening until companies like Entrade have come along and managed to get markets going. But there I think that there is a real concern that without these markets functioning properly, development really will be hampered. And so I think so long as it's all working okay, and I think there is a real hope there that it will. But I think that that's the kind of concern, that that would be the biggest impact. And of course, holding up development might sound like a good thing to some people. Like that might sound quite nice if you kind of don't want some development in your backyard. But actually, that's probably as a society, a really rather bad thing. Like we have a housing problem in the UK. We have a target for 300,000 new homes. We're already obviously failing to deliver on that. And so if biodiversity net gain rather does become a barrier, then I think that that's a real concern there. But I think broadly, we shouldn't be seeing huge impacts on people's everyday lives other than through this natural habitat being restored in places that it otherwise wouldn't.
Which I'm sure, Dan, I'm sure you'll agree, it's not a lot of impact, as it were, but there's a lot of benefit.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the whole point of doing this is to positively benefit nature at the end of the day, and thereby we benefit from the huge amounts of, well, they're nameless and innumerable, are they not, the benefits from nature, both personally and economically and socially and environmentally.
So the three of you, you're all from different organisations, different parts within this journey. How are you working together on this?
My role at the University of Exeter is in Exeter Innovation, which is one of the non-academic departments. Our job is to facilitate partnerships and draw down innovation funding and ensure that the impact of the research that we do here at the university has real world solutions. And I work across nature, recovery and food systems, terrestrial stuff. So anyone who wants to get involved in any questions, I've heard a bit about some of the innovation needs around verification, for example, biodiversity net gain. We've got a lot of companies that we're helping to do that. And also the platforms required to set these things up and trade for money from BNG. So an example of which is our collaboration with Entrade that our colleagues will tell you a little more about.
Thanks, Dan. Just for background, we've been working with Entrade for about 5 years now. Actually, it's seven, I think. Yes, it's a bit more than five. To begin with, that was on facilitating markets which the water companies were buying water quality improvement services. And then as these new legislations emerged, we shifted our focus onto solving this challenge that's brought about by this new legislation which acts on developers rather than on water companies. And the key kind of partnership that we've developed is about the design of these markets, which can bring together developers and landowners and facilitate trade. And the key service that we're able to offer is through the aggregation of both supply and demand. So we're no longer facilitating kind of one-to-one trades, but rather we aggregate both on the supply and the demand side. And then we do that in a way that's particularly efficient and fair to both sides of the market, while also maintaining total transparency so that it's entirely clear for everybody, both within the market and outside, where these credits are coming from, that these credits are genuine, that they are being monitored and that they are being verified, while also ensuring that landowners are receiving a fair price for those credits that they're supplying for the habitat creation that they're doing, while developers are not being required to pay through the roof for these credits that is happening in potentially other market designs. That's come about through this kind of collaboration coming through from the university and Entrade, and able to kind of solve these problems by us bringing academic expertise on how to facilitate these trades alongside Entrade, as well as other partners within the wider consortium, on how to ensure these markets are really transparent, really are reporting, and really are kind of genuine credits that are coming forward and being exchanged. I don't know.
And some of that has been through quite a unique settlement mechanism in terms of how those trades are matched. Did you want to talk a bit about the Lindsay mechanism?
So that's the key part at the heart of this, which aggregates on both sides of the market, is the Lindsay mechanism. So developers will come forward and say how much they're willing to pay. And on the other side of the market, for the credits that they require for a particular development. And then on the other side of the market, farmers can come forward, or landowners more broadly, but this is largely farmers, and say how much money they would require to cover their costs to go ahead with some habitat creation, be that woodland planting, wetland creation, something like that. And then what we do is we account for all of the rules within the biodiversity metric on how these two parties can be matched up. But what we're doing is aggregating. So we're aggregating on the supply side, aggregating landowners together who can facilitate the supply of the biodiversity credits that are acquired by those developers. And we look for the solution which generates the biggest gap as it were, between the amount that the developers have said they can pay and the amount that the sellers have required in terms of their costs. And then we allocate that gap, that surplus that we're creating, that value that we're kind of generating through this market, we allocate that back to the participants. So developers always pay less than they said that they were willing to, and suppliers always get paid more than they said they needed. And so that's what really kind of is the fairness at the heart of this. And that also facilitates extremely efficient trade, which is key really to making sure that development can go ahead and that this legislation actually stays in place, which I think is an incredibly important thing as well.
Absolutely, very much so. Amy, Ben and Dan, thank you very much for joining us here on this episode. Amy, very quickly, I guess we can Google Entrade if we want to find out more information, yes?
Yes, or other search engines are available.
They are indeed. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Innovation Conversations. Recorded by Fresh Air Studios on location at Southwest Innovation Expo, Sandy Park, Exeter, on the 5th of March 2024. This podcast was produced as a joint venture between the University of Exeter and the University of Plymouth. Presented by Paul Philpott. Engineering and video editing by Mark Stevenson. Audio editing by Martin Burgess Moon. Production assistance by Lisa Hartwell. Producers for the University of Exeter, Marina Alto, Georgia Brown, and Andrew Dean. Producers for the University of Plymouth, Rich Adams and Melanie Jones. Copyright University of Exeter and University of Plymouth.